You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, June 11th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, from interviews I did at Netroots Nation 2012 in Providence, Rhode Island, Heather Hurlburt, director of the National Security Network, and Matt Duss of Center for the American Progress on the worsening situation in Syria. Also on the program, from a recording I did at Netroots Nation, Shannon Moore, activist radio host from Alaska, on the Pebble Mine situation, which threatens the 40% of our nation's seafood. Only 40%. It's not like we don't have the Gulf of Mexico to get all that, the rest of our seafood. All that and more on the program. Also, cops in Florida saying goodbye to Rick Scott. The Nation magazine coming out strongly against kill lists. More and more, we've talked about this on the program. 60-year-olds, 55-year-olds, just waiting to get on early retirement for Social Security, and how much that's going to, how much pain that's going to inflict because they can't get jobs. And finally, we'll talk about a piece that claims that liberals are responsible for the right-wing media, for the rise of right-wing media, or some such nonsense. All that and more on the program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I am back from Netroots Nation. Still tired. Still exhausted. Over the course of this week, I've got a bunch of interviews that we're gonna run from my time there. I may even take a day off and just lard it up with interviews. I spoke to Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Senator Sherrod Brown. Oh, gosh. Spoke to some folks for the National Abolition of the Death Penalty. Pretty interesting stuff. Marcus Melitzis. Oh, I can't even get over how many people I spoke to, in addition to the ones you already heard. Joel Rubin from Plowshares Fund, Jesse LaGreca, Forrest Brown from the PCCC, Dave Zirin, who writes for The Nation on sports. Great interview with Bill McKibben. You will enjoy it this week. We will get to it. Let me start, and then we'll go to these interviews. Oh, I should also say I will be on the Dylan Radigan program today, which I believe will probably be my second to last appearance on that program. Ever. because the Dylan Radigan program is going to be ending, I believe, at the end of next week. I'll have more to say about that later, but if you want to catch my swan songs. In fact, you know, today I shaved. I shaved last night. I hadn't shaved all week. And we may be going back into scruffy cedar mode. Because if I don't have to go on television, I'm not going to shave. And I may even institute a new rule that I won't shave for television unless you pay me. It used to be when I was an actor, you would not get the contact lenses unless you paid me. I need to get paid well, and then I put the contact lenses on. And if you want my character to wear glasses, I put the contact lenses on, and I wear a fake pair of glasses. So, I don't know, folks. My extended period of trying to dress more like an adult and shave and be more that may be coming to a close, because I just don't think that I've got much future in this political talk television world, not on the cable channels anyways. So that's the good news. May not have to shave as much. Got an email. And, you know, I generally don't read these in this part of the program, but it combines sort of two things that I want to talk about. Well, first off is The Nation magazine came out with a very strongly worded editorial about we can't afford to be silent on these drone strike program that the Obama administration has implemented. Now, understand, if we're talking about drones attacking people on a battlefield, if we're talking about we're engaged in a war and we're on a battlefield, these things become a lot less complicated. Perhaps no less lethal, but if we're talking about fighting an army or clearly militants, that's fine. But, I mean, we spent some time going over this drone program, and there's nothing clear about this. Signal strikes, we don't even know who we're hitting. We don't even know who we're hitting. We're just hitting an area where we think there might be militants. And we also have a policy of naming anyone that we hit with a drone as a de facto militant because we hit them with a drone. So it really goes a long way into cutting down to that collateral damage, because there's no such thing as collateral damage anymore. And the notion that we can kill an American citizen with a drone strike without judicial review, that the notion that we no longer have a standard of judicial review as a function of due process, but rather a committee of people who are just in the business of killing other people, is ridiculous. So this is something we should be talking about. And I'm glad to see The Nation is. I don't see it in many other places, frankly, although Chris Hayes, of course, had his Nation colleague, Jeremy Scahill, on the program, I think it was a week or so ago, to talk about it. And I think that's why The Nation came out strong, because Scahill was attacked for pointing this out. But I got an email from listener. And he said, Dear Sam, I've been listening to your program for about a year and a half. Before that, I caught you on Air America. You do a fine job, as fine a job as can be expected within the context of American politics. Well, yeah, I do speak within the context of American politics. And that's the problem. The latter has become a complete charade, corrupt through and through, with no end in sight. Tough for me to argue. I would quibble maybe at the margins, but so when I hear Senator Merkley, for whom I voted, utter the phrase, take it to the American people, I want to throw up. When was the last time the politicians listened to the 99%? I interviewed Sarah Merkley on Friday from Netroots Nation. I can understand some jadedness as to the notion of taking it to the American public. Although I could point out some nominal movement, at the very least in rhetoric, as a function of what the American public has done. But send more money, shouts the Obama camp, because Romney raised more in May than they did. Disgusting. The other thing is, all right, so let me just take that. I'm not giving any money to politicians right now. I can just tell you that. Because I do have a certain measure of disgust. But, and I'm not saying that people shouldn't or should. I'm just talking me personally. The other thing is, I know you're going to vote for Obama. It is true. I have stated that I will probably vote for Obama. And when I say that, understand that I'm making that statement in the capacity as a host of this show. In other words, I live in New York State. I have a certain latitude as a because I live in New York State. But when I say that I'm going to probably vote for Obama, I am saying that because in the context of that, I think it's important, particularly in a swing state, that people vote for Obama over Romney, unless somehow we have some miraculous third choice that is actually viable, which it doesn't seem possible to me. That's fine. That's your prerogative. But that's where I draw the line. His drones killed children, children like your own. He pursues whistleblowers with unprecedented vengeance, strips us of our civil rights, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, I know these things because I've covered these things extensively on this program. Extensively. Perhaps more so than on virtually any other program. There's probably a couple out there but it's certainly more so than any other program with the resources that we have. Your rationale is that Romney would be worse, kill more children and so forth. Oh, yes, and the Supreme Court. Romney will appoint conservatives, i.e. fascists like Roberts. Yes, he will, and Democrats will just go along. Obama will appoint candidates that are to the right as well because Republicans know he can be had and won't stand for anything less than another conservative. The Supreme Court, another corrupt institution that should have been dumped years ago. All right, well, regardless of whether or not you think that somehow something should have dumped the Supreme Court, that's not going to happen. I don't know the mechanism in which that could happen. What you're talking about is fantastical. What really should happen, if that's the way that we can think, is that I should just be appointed president with the power to overturn everything that we both disagree with. That's what really should happen. And then there's a whole list of other subsidiary happenings that could happen that would make things even better. And yes, Obama will probably follow the trend of replacing anyone sitting on the court, at least on the four, with someone who is more conservative. But there is no doubt in my mind that if President Obama replaces one of the five, that will probably be the first time in 50 years that a Supreme Court appointee would actually move the balance of power towards the left. Even if it's a marginal change. Will it be a corporatist liberal? Probably. But relative to Romney, who would undoubtedly appoint a Roberts or an Alito or a Thomas, there's no debate there. You can also say, well, the Supreme Court's a sham and it should be completely wiped away. Well, that's not going to happen. It's still going to make very important decisions that are going to continue to dictate our lives in some very important ways. But then he goes on to ask me his most pressing question. Let's take this a step further. Would you still vote for Obama if he promises to build fewer concentration camps than Romney? The answer is an unequivocal, absolute yes. And in fact, I would go further. It is morally repugnant of you if you believe that candidate A will create more concentration camps in this hypothetical than candidate B to in any way aid or abet the election of that candidate A. Because I'm speaking in those terms because you're obviously writing to me with some type of moral righteousness. Look in the mirror and tell yourself that you are morally righteous because you would knowingly aid and abet someone who's going to create more concentration camps than less. Think about what you're arguing here. Would you tell a partisan in 1944, that if you can't get rid of all the concentration camps, there's no point in eliminating one of them? It's just absurd. He goes on to say, I cannot give money to a person who will vote for a candidate who kills civilians and continues to fight a war in Afghanistan despite promises to get out. Well, first of all, President Obama never, as a candidate, promised to get out of Afghanistan. And I actually do think that we're going to be getting out of Afghanistan even quicker than has been announced. But that's besides the point. If you think that you will ever have the opportunity to vote for an American president who could win, or even perhaps, yes, who could win, that we'll never spend our tax dollars on killing people. Then you have better insight or you're going to live a lot longer than I am. I mean, I get your drift. But you understand that if Romney allows his advisors and is dictated by his foreign policy advisors and starts a war with Iran, that by not voting, you are voting, giving Romney a half vote in the event that he wins. That's just the math. It's just completely the reality. That's why I stopped subscribing to mainstream newspapers that helped us get into wars, and that's why I must stop subscribing to your program. So please terminate my $10 a month payment. I appreciate it. Best of luck to you. I got no problem with someone ending their subscription to this program, particularly if you think it's going to help in some way prevent wars. But there's no logic here. You're just acting out like a child. There's absolutely no logic here. Never have I in any way ever helped promote war on this. Let me rephrase this, actually. Because I think I was on balance in favor of the Libyan intervention. Put aside for a moment the fact that I felt that Congress should have authorized it. But it doesn't seem to be what you're talking about here. And I'm not quite sure that that was, well, for the sake of argument, let's say it was a war. But the idea in some way that you are going to prevent wars or whatnot, it's just simply misguided. And I actually have far less of a problem with your end of subscription than the righteousness in which you talk about the voting. Take that $10 and a month and, I don't know, make an art project that talks about, but you should go out and vote still. And you should vote for someone you believe who has a chance. You should not throw away your vote. And understand that you have no more leverage than I do at this point. And if you think this is going to teach President Obama a lesson, I got news for you. I'm aware of you canceling your subscription. And I know exactly what to attribute it to. You don't show up to vote, I guarantee you, there will be no narrative that it's because of drones or whatnot. None. Zero. It will have absolutely no impact other than to make yourself feel more righteous. But as you're feeling more righteous, just remember that in some way you think it's okay that that extra additional concentration camp in your hypothetical exists. It's actually a great hypothetical. If you were a partisan and you had the ability to shut one of 10 concentration camps, would you say, not gonna? Because there's no difference between 10 concentration camps and 9 concentration camps. So to heck with it. I'm going to stay at home and feel very righteous that I just believe there should be no concentration camps. Good luck with that. All right, folks. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to play my recording of an interview I did with Matt Duss and Heather Hurlburt at Netroots Nation just a short 2 days ago. I can't remember. We'll be right back with that, and then you'll hear from me before we go into it with Shannon Moore. Continuing our coverage from Netroots Nation in Providence, Rhode Island, 2012. Joining me now, it's a pleasure to be talking to both Heather Hurlburt, the executive director of the National Security Network, and Matt Duss of the Center for American Progress. Almost, you're at the center of the Center of American Progress. Thank you for joining us. So I wanted to talk to both you guys because we have a real problem, or maybe we don't have a problem, but the world has a problem in Syria right now. Heather, give us just a sense of what's going on there at this moment.
So at this point, you have a leader who, in order to stay in power, is not just willing to kill thousands of his own citizens, is not just willing to kill little kids by gouging out their eyes, but is anxious to do it in a way that sets ethnic groups against ethnic groups and that basically says, either you have me or you have exploding civil conflict that flows outside my borders. And he's trying to set up a scenario where, frankly, we end up with both of those things.
Matt, well, tell us how this this has the potential to essentially spread in the region.
Well, as Heather said, one of the things Bashar al-Assad has going for him is that there are a number of different religious groups in Syria. His own, the Alawites, is a minority group, but he's managed to patch together a sort of ruling coalition, for lack of a better term, that kind of pits these groups against each other but stays on top. He has exported some of this violence to Lebanon in the past, in the very recent past, and if this were to escalate more, you would see, I think, fairly quickly different groups and states in the region start to intervene, if not overtly, then certainly behind the scenes supporting their favored proxies. We saw some of this happening in Iraq, so we could get to a very similar situation very quickly.
Heather, who would be the first, do you imagine, in the region to intervene? What parties would be the first?
So it is going to get worse, by the way. I think it's time to stop pretending that there's any outcome under which this doesn't get worse before it gets better. And the first people who will have to do something will be our ally, Turkey, because they are bearing the bulk of the refugee flows. They have an ethnic minority that crosses over the border. And their economy, which was booming, is being affected by this. They also have, by the way, one of the region's biggest armies other than the Syrian army. So they're going to be the first ones who are final. And, you know, their soldiers have already been fired on. So they're eventually going to be the ones who say, hey, this has to be stopped. And by the way, we don't want to stop it alone. And at that point, they'll turn to us, and we're going to have some really tough choices to make.
And, we discussed before that the Saudis have a different agenda. How is the Saudi agenda different?
Well, for one thing, the Saudis never like to see an autocratic leader pushed aside. So, and second, they have...
I just don't want to give anybody any ideas.
Well, yeah, it sets a bad precedent. Okay. You know, I mean, in this business that you can actually achieve democracy is also kind of nerve-wracking for them. So the Saudis, you know, were interested in how can we maximally preserve stability. Second, the Saudis have a very strong stake in the sectarian conflict in Lebanon not getting any further out of hand, and basically not empowering Shiites, who you will remember are also the folks who are the majority in Iran, and who are now an increasingly empowered plurality in Lebanon. They are the Saudis' opponents and religious as well as political foes, and so the Saudis will viciously resist any solution that seems to give Shiites more power in the region, which is going to be a problem.
But it's possible at one point, Matt, that the Saudis will end up essentially agreeing with Turkey on this, right? That at one point they could both say, all right, it's time. It's gotten bad enough. I mean, that seems to be the dynamic, isn't it? That everyone's just waiting for it to get bad enough for it to definitely make sense to take action.
Right. I think once it became clear to the Saudis that the preservation of any sense of stability was no longer served by what they were doing, I mean, I think we could see them change. But I do just want to echo something. She made reference to the Shiite-Sunni divide, and I think we really have to understand that that is what really underlies what's happening. Not only are they a majority in Iran, they are a majority of in Iraq, and our invasion of Iraq overturned a system in which the Sunni minority had ruled for decades, empowered the Shiite majority. And this has sort of boosted Shiite concerns Sunni concerns about Shiites in the region. Saudi Arabia has an active Shiite majority. We saw Bahrain. That's what Saudi Arabia's intervention in Bahrain was very much about, maintaining a Sunni monarchy over a Shiite majority. So this is on everyone's mind.
How will this affect Jordan? Does that sectarian divide play out in Jordan, or is it simply just there's this sense of destabilization in the region?
Right. We don't see there's no similar Sunni-Shia divide in Jordan, but Jordan, from people I talk to who pay very close attention, seems to be I mean, we've seen a very active Muslim Brotherhood there for some time. People are, there's real dissatisfaction. We haven't seen the huge demonstrations that we've seen elsewhere. But a lot of people have said for a while that Jordan, something is bubbling up in Jordan, and something could happen at any moment.
And from Israel's perspective, where maybe it might be easier to say where don't they see some type of threat, but where what is the most immediate threat that they perceive coming out of this particular dynamic?
So Assad kept things calm on the Golan Heights, on the disputed border between Syria and Israel, and kept that in kind of a perpetual state of deep freeze that was politically useful for both sides. And both sides were pretty confident that violence was not going to flare up. That confidence is completely undermined now. The Israelis are worried about incursions. You know, there's this joke making the rounds in Syria. Where's the safest place in Syria? The Golan Heights. So the Israelis are scared to death that one border that they thought they had stable and under control is now going to become just as unpredictable and frightening to them as the Egyptian border has become. And then if they think about Jordan, I mean, they're tremendously vulnerable from Jordan, besides the fact that there being so many Palestinians in Jordan. So for the Israelis, there's nothing comforting in all of this, and there's no solution that the Israelis see as returning the kind of stability that they had.
Is there any implications regarding Iran in all of this, Matt?
Certainly. I mean, Iran is Bashar al-Assad's main state backer. It has been for a while. His Alawi minority is a sect of Shiism. So that's a way for them to, you know, bridge that divide between Persian ethnic and Arab ethnic, Eastern Arab Shiite, and that's also their bridge into Lebanon. I mean, that's been diminished to some extent as Assad's appeal to the region has been diminished. But clearly, the Iranians would take a very big strategic hit if Assad were to fall.
But they're not going to play. They don't really have the opportunity to play any type of role in how this sort of resolves itself.
Oh, they do. They do. They have for one thing, they're playing a major role now by supplying Assad with weapons, according to some allegations, with actual personnel, although I'm not sure how well substantiated those are, and with, you know, sort of how to jam your opponent's internet sites. So they're playing a very strong role in propping Assad up, and they could, anytime they chose, play a role in, you know, saying, if they said, Assad, we're not going to support you anymore, that would have an immediate effect, and it would then let them have some seat at the table over what came afterward.
Who would give them that seat? I mean, presumably it's the Russians, right, who at this point are the ones who have the most sway, perhaps, over getting Assad out, or no?
Well, I mean, I think, Matt, actually, you might speak to what the Iranians did in Iraq, which they could certainly replicate in Syria if they wanted to. They would give themselves a seat at the table by who they chose to support.
I think that's right. I mean, getting back to Russia, I think they have influence in that they are the biggest check on what we can do in the Security Council. They've made clear that, especially after Libya, they're not going to sign on to anything that could then turn into an actual intervention on behalf of an opposition, as they feel happened in Libya. So they have asked, just today, they had asked officially that Iran be included in talks. But yeah, clearly Iran is already involved, and I think the Iraq example is a good one. Not only they're very good at making relationships with as many players as possible in any given situation.
I was familiar with the dynamic of that because Libya, the Libya intervention went so far that it soured Russia and China in many respects, made them gun-shy because they saw the UN mandate extended beyond where they wanted it to, and so they have less trust in that process. Mm-hmm. But why was that necessarily not in their interests? Or let me put it this way. Why was they didn't seem to be particularly invested in Gaddafi. Is it that they didn't have a problem with the outcome as much as they did, they had a problem with the process? And if it was a different place than one of their client states, they may not have a problem with the process, because if it led to that outcome. In other words, they really care that that Gaddafi was gone, or did they just become suspicious of that process and applying it to a place where they did care?
What the Russians care about is any time you suggest that a government doesn't have total control over what it chooses to do to its own citizens inside its own borders. And so the Russians said, okay, because, number one, we don't like Gaddafi that much either, and number two, this threat is so outrageous, we're willing to let you go a certain way. But we're not willing to go so far as to say the UN can decide that you don't get to be in power anymore. Because the Russians look around and they see Chechnya and other parts of Russia which have said, you know, we don't really want to be part of Russia anymore. And the Russians imagine a day where the UN would say, hey, you know what? You've killed all the people you can kill to keep region X a part of your country. And that's the big strategic question that's at the back of the Russians' mind every time this comes up.
And that's the same question for the Chinese, right? I mean, they have that same, they don't want to set some type of international precedent where their sovereignty can in some way be infringed upon.
That's right.
It's that dynamic is so strange. It's not strange, but it's a little bit mind-blowing because it's also, you know, just today, you know, there's a documentary out by the right wing about how the UN is, you know, secretly undoing our sovereignty. And there's a UN, you know, plan number 21 or something that is going to, I don't know, steal all our eggs, or I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, we were both on the call about that this morning.
I told you not to tell him about
we
that.
We have blown the lid off this thing. It's going there. Apparently, there all the countries come up the superhighway, which is going to, you know, replace
right.
the Mexican Texas border. But I mean, the interesting thing, so you see that sort of, there's a similar sort of notion of the fear of sovereignty, but it's slightly different, isn't it? And I have such trouble imagining a situation where we would do that with a place like Chechnya, but I guess it's their job to worry about that, or, I mean, is that a possibility that there are people in our government who have designs on sort of liberating Chechnya?
Well, there are certainly people in our government who've made statements over the years opposing human rights violations in Chechnya and saying, you know, you guys are not doing right by your own country. And the Russians, mind you, also remember that the U.S. was perfectly happy to see all the former Soviet republics secede. And so there's a sense in which people may feel, well, Chechnya is ours just the same way as Georgia was ours, and the Americans, you know, made us give Georgia away. I mean,
right.
not militarily.
Right.
So, and then the Chinese, you think about the rafts and rafts of Americans who stand up for human rights in Tibet. And the Chinese look at that and say, well, you wouldn't like it if we came along and said, you know, you're mistreating Texas, you need to give it back to Mexico. And it's true, we wouldn't. It's just that most of us understand that there's no serious threat of that happening, you know, black helicopters taking our lawn furniture notwithstanding.
Let me ask you just one more somewhat unrelated question. But about a week and a half ago, the New York Times reported that the Stuxnet attack on the Iranian nuclear facility where they're enriching uranium was who was responsible in this case. And everyone suspected that it was Israel and the United States that was engaged in this in the first place, but this is a little bit more definitive. What are the implications within the domestically in Iran for that revelation to be so codified?
First of all, I think we have to say if this were a similar attack on us,
that was my next question.
By Iran, I think we know very well what the domestic reaction, what the government reaction would be. It would be, this is an act of war, and we must respond with war. Or
statutorily, I think that we've already...
So I think that, you know, the Iranians clearly, it slowed their work. I think that we see evidence that that's the case. I'm not sure how much... But no, I think this, we've only begun to think through the implications for this new era of cyber warfare. In a sense, we're waiting, or I'm waiting, you know, for something to happen that's really going to clue people into what a potential threat this is.
Well, what are the implications? Is it not better than actual bombing? Is it if it was done as a way of sort of slowing Israel's roll, I guess. Yeah. I mean, how do you, as someone who studies this and is engaged in both of you on a daily basis, how do you perceive that? Was it smart to do?
Well, it's better. It's better than airstrikes. Yes, less violent, less complicated. But it does. It just gets to the point that technology just completely outpaces our ability to come up with thinking through some of the legal implications of what this will mean.
So I'd say there's two sets of implications that you have to weigh, and the job of policymakers is to weigh this. And where I think we're lagging disastrously behind as a society, and especially where Congress is lagging disastrously behind in providing any kind of meaningful oversight, is thinking through, on the one hand, as Matt says, it's better not to have used military force, it's better not to have had an act of war, it's better to have communicated to the Iranians both we want to talk to you and you're not going to be completely unconstrained to do anything you want. On the other hand, we also know back from a few years ago when Iran was freer before the 2009 elections and we could do public opinion research, that a majority of Iranians said we would be willing to trade away a nuclear weapons capability for the end of sanctions and reopening to the world. And the question is, does this kind of thing, which sure feels like an act of war when you're on the receiving end of it, does that eat away the attitudes in Iranian society that in the long run are what we need for Iran to have a government that is a more constructive international actor, which is, you know, the long-term goal here? And how do you weigh those two things? And are you really, as a government, doing an intelligent long-term weighing of those two trade-offs? And how do we, as citizens, and how does Congress, as our elected representatives, provide some kind of oversight of that?
Matt Duss of the Center for American Progress, Heather Hilbert, the Executive Director of the National Security Network. Thank you so much for joining me here at Netroots Nation. All right. That was the interview that I did with Heather Hilbert and Matt Duss at Netroots Nation. And now here is an interview I did with Shannon Moore from Alaska. We've spoken to her before on Pebble Mine situation up there. It is, it's pretty stunning. I think the only thing that's happened since we actually did this interview was that there's been an extended period of time for commenting on the EPA evaluation of this. But here's the interview. Back in a minute. Shannon, we spoke a year ago, actually, at Netroots Nation 2011 about the Pebble Mine situation. Tell us again, what is Pebble Mine? What are we talking about? This is could be another Valdez in some way, couldn't it?
It could. The Pebble Mine is a proposed mine in Alaska. It's an open pit mine, which creates, you know, cyanide and all kinds of nasty things. It's not so much the mine, as horrific as that may just seem in itself, the largest ever proposed in North America. You could see it from space, kind of horrific story. The real situation with this mine is location, like it is with so many things. And the proposal is to put it at the headwaters of Bristol Bay, which is in western Alaska. People that watch The Deadliest Catch, those ships, all of those crabbing boats are crabbing right off of Bristol Bay. It's a pretty amazing place. It's the largest wild salmon run in the world, has been consistently for decades, for centuries, and it provides 40% of the nation's seafood. So it's also a food security issue. So,
At the head of Bristol Bay, what you're talking about is obviously on land, right?
Right, right, and basically there's all these tributaries and rivers, the Nooshkeag, the Klijak. There's all these. And the Ushakak, all these rivers that go up in there, we have salmon that are spawning and going 100 miles upstream to spawn in 2 inches of water. So if you take all of that space out, all of their breeding ground is gone. And there's a real potential that that mining drainage would come downriver as well.
That's the people. The thing that people, I think, have to understand is that in the process of mining, there's always a toxic stew of sludge.
Yes.
That comes up that, like you say, contains all sorts of toxins.
Unlivables with no shelf life. I mean, it's like they'll last forever. And this is a 20-mile-long sludge pit. that's going to be left.
That's essentially going to border if they have their way.
Right, billions of tons. It'll actually not even border. It's right on top of it.
And so, okay, so what has taken place over the past year? Where does that stand now?
Well, you know, it's been amazing because this fight has been really localized, with the exception of folks like yourself picking up this issue. But Trout Unlimited and several other groups have worked really hard to make it a national issue. And nine Native tribes, Native corporation, and huge amount of fishing groups, sport, commercial, subsistence, got together and asked the EPA if they could please do an assessment. Would they please do an assessment? Because the Clean Water Act has a provision in it, the 404C, which says that the federal government can stop a mine. They can stop a project before it even starts.
Are there not regularly assessments done of mines? I mean, is this something that you have to have a special request?
You know, it depends on who your governor is.
Uh-huh.
And this is on state property. And one of the interesting things that I dug up this year was that, you know, Alaska's just a little over 50 years old. And when we first became a state, the federal government owned, they were in control of Bristol Bay. But every year, the state legislature would pass a resolution that would say, you need to make this a salmon habitat. You need to make this a salmon habitat. And, you know, a decade and a half goes by, and finally the federal government goes, really, state of Alaska? You know what? We need to do a land trade with you because we need to keep our treaties with Alaska Native people. They need acreage. So we're going to trade you millions of acres. Several million acres we're going to trade you. We're going to give you Bristol Bay watershed so that you can make it a salmon habitat and quit bitching and moaning at us. And so Alaska was like, great. So it was the largest land trade ever made in the history of America without a war, like for Texas, or a purchase for Louisiana. So it was this huge land swap. So the state of Alaska took control of it, and then the Republicans took control of Alaska. Alaska was a very, very progressive state. So,
and so the senator didn't request the governor didn't request it, but people did. The EPA was requested to do this study. Have they completed this study?
They just completed it several weeks ago, and this was a tremendous thing to get them to even do. The governor of our state and our senators have all stated the EPA has no business coming into Alaska and affecting our enterprise. I find
the
ironic.
The Environmental Protection Agency has no business assessing whether or not this could be a very, very detrimental thing for our environment.
Right, which I've written columns about this. My whole theory is, like, this isn't an overreach. This is a rescue. You know, I was a commercial fisherman for many years of my life, and whenever a boat was going down, no one ever said, you know, mayday, mayday, for the love of God, don't get that overreaching Coast Guard.
Right.
But I got an engine fire.
Right. We don't want the federal.
I don't want the overreach.
I don't want the federal government messing with my rescue.
Right.
Right.
So just send local, if you would, because this is a state's rights. I mean, nobody's ever said that. And this is a real rescue. And like any development project.
So wait, what did the EPA say in their report?
The EPA assessment, and they took, you know, over a year to put together this assessment. And there's several things that happen. One is this assessment that comes out, then it's hearings. And then it's like white paper review, science review of their assessment. They basically said that even if nothing ever went wrong with this mine, it would still have an effect on the salmon fishery, which is huge.
So best case scenario, it's going to hurt the supply of the supply, which provides 40% of the nation's seafood. I mean, this is for people who don't care about the potential harm in terms of the environment.
Right.
We're just looking at it in terms of
food security
and the economic security of everybody involved in that process of getting 40% of the nation's seafood to the rest of the nation. So the EPA has made this in the assessment, and now we're moving into the comment period.
We've gone into the hearing part, and, you know, we've had, I think, seven hearings in Alaska. There was a hearing in Washington. Senator Maria Cantwell, amazingly enough, has come out in complete support of this because so many fishermen fish, you know, out of Washington State. Uh-huh. They fish the entire coast. So she's been really supportive and great about this. Our own senators are really sort of trying to stay in the middle of the road, which gets them hit on both sides.
And what are the, we just have a minute left, but what are the big forces that are fighting for this, obviously? I mean, we're talking big oil, and are there other forces that
there,
are?
There are. At the point, I mean, it was just the mining companies pretty much when it was just in Alaska. But now the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has come in. I met with one of their lawyers, and he told me, look, we don't give a rat's ass about mining or salmon. We don't care about your happy Eskimos, none of this, he says. But he says, what we care about is that the potential of the EPA of shutting down any development before it is permitted, before it starts, this should never happen. You should never, ever be able to stop a project. But a project like the Pebble Mine and a place as pristine as Bristol Bay, I mean, if you're not going to pull the 404C now, which is the emergency brake of the Clean Water Act, get rid of it. You don't need it. You're never going to use it.
So in other words, not only do you have obviously the forces that are going to make money from the mine, but this is also an ideological fight. We do not want the EPA, they're saying,
it's
to ever protect our environment at the cost of anybody's money.
It is completely ideological, and both of those corporations that work on this mine are foreign owned. They're Canadian and British. So
wonderful.
Thank you
Shannon
so much,
Moore,
Sam.
Thank you so much for joining us. All right, folks, that is our program for today. We will head into the better half of the show. And this is traditionally where I ask you to become a member of the Majority Report to support the program. It will ensure that it will continue. As a bonus, we give you some extra time, some extra content, and some swag. But really, really, we should actually change it from member to just supporter. Because you will make the show available not just for yourself, but for others, which increases its influence. We have pretty good numbers based upon talking to some other people on some other shows. And you can help it grow by supporting the program, by subscribing to the program for money as opposed to for free. And then, of course, give us a review on iTunes. DonateYourAccount.com. Merch. Spread the word. Join us in the better half. You can call the program 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Tomorrow on the program, Elliot Spitzer will be joining me. You can IM me at Majority FM. The rest of the week, we'll also have some bonus material for members from Netroots Nation. I think I said iTunes review. Also, the rest of the week, like I said, more interviews from Netroots Nation, a couple of senators, a couple of advocates. Talk more about my Netroots Nation. Oh, and a interesting story wherein I was asked to sign a body part of a convention goer. And did. I know the pictures are floating around out there somewhere. Matt is really wondering what's going on. The first thing I did when I got home is I had to tell Nikki, because I didn't want her to see pictures of it without me having at least contextualized it first. Hopefully people won't recognize me because I wasn't shaving. See you in the better half.